The Rebel Capitalist Show, episode 177.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hi guys, welcome to today's live stream. I hope you all had a very Merry Christmas. I'm here in the temporary office in Phoenix, Arizona. I was fortunate enough to go up and hang out with my mom for Christmas in Las Vegas, and then tried to do some skiing in Flagstaff, Arizona. That was, let me put it to you this way. If you're planning on going skiing right now in Arizona, I would shelf that idea until after we get done with the cerveza sickness. Because it's more of a hassle than it's worth right now, guys. Especially if you're like me and kind of get a little bit fed up with the whole mask thing. You're not going to enjoy skiing at all, I can tell you that. But anyway, so first off, guys, make sure you check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. We are headed into some dangerous times in the market. Real estate, bonds, Bitcoin, Ethereum. Look what happened to Ripple the other day. That was pretty crazy. Who knows? I don't really know whether it's going to bounce back or not. I don't really have a take on it. Maybe Lynn has a take, Lynn Alden. But my point, you get it, is now is the time to be prepared or be a victim. You have to start educating yourself. And there's no better place to take your investing to the next level than with Rebel Capitalist Pro. That's the online forum I have with Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. So guys, check it out as soon as we get done with the live stream today. It's at georgegammon.com/pro. Of course, the web address isn't on my t-shirt, but you get it. Rebel Capitalist Pro. That's what you want to look for. All right, let's dive into your questions. We're going to start here with Mr. or Mrs. Aaron Ford. Please describe how QE only really increases asset prices and not M1 supplies unless it's injected via helicopter money. Okay. So, Aaron, when they do quantitative easing, they, meaning the Fed, they are buying assets from the banks themselves. So how do they buy those assets? They, meaning the Fed. They create bank reserves, and they do what Snyder calls an asset swap. So if that bank has treasuries or mortgage-backed securities, the Fed prints up bank reserves, gives the bank those additional reserves, and then they take the treasuries or the mortgage-backed securities. So the only difference is instead of having mortgage-backed securities or treasuries, the bank, as an asset on their balance sheet, now just has bank reserves. So you got to start by understanding that's the only thing that that changes. That's the only difference. So the next question becomes, okay, what do the banks do with those bank reserves that they couldn't otherwise do with maybe treasuries or mortgage-backed securities that could have the effect of increasing the stock market, let's say? Well, it just gives them additional balance sheet capacity to extend more loans than they otherwise could have. So they're going to look around for entities to lend money to with the most skewed, let's call it risk reward, with the most favorable risk reward. In the past, that was finding an entrepreneur who had a profitable business model and extending them loans so they could grow their business. But since 2008, most of you guys that are paying attention, I'm sure, know that the banks don't really fund businesses anymore. They don't fund productivity. They don't fund the growth or the increase of a society producing more goods and services at an ever efficient rate. So what do? Well, they look around and say, okay, well, how can we make a bigger return with less downside? Aha! We think that there's a Fed put. So if we just increase our balance sheet by increasing loans, let's say, and give those loans to hedge funds, Well, we're definitely going to get paid back because the hedge funds will never lose money because the Fed won't let them lose money because they don't want the market to go down. There's a Fed put. If these hedge funds or financial institutions know what they're doing, then we're definitely going to get repaid. So you see balance sheet capacity being, you see balance sheet capacity being used to create loans that increase asset prices instead of creating loans that increase the amount of goods and services that are being produced by a society. So who is kind of picking up the slack? That would be the venture capitalist funds, right? So they get all this money because the pensions can no longer get the 7% yield they need. So they take all of their billions and billions, give them to the VCs and say, guys, get us that 7% return we need. And the VCs look around and they say, well, shoot, we're just like the banks. We don't see anyone we could fund. We don't see any entrepreneurs out there that have a good profitable business model that we could give them capital and they could grow their model, take it public, and we could make a big return. There's not that many people out there relative to the amount of money that we now have under management because we've just been bombarded with capital from all these pension funds because the Fed dropped interest rates so low they can't get a return. Right? So they have to go further out the risk curve. That's why the VCs have so much more money. But those VCs are competing for the same amount of good entrepreneurs that have profitable businesses. I would argue the amount has gone down since 2008. So they have an even less pool, or they have an even smaller pool of entrepreneurs with good profitable businesses to choose from. So what do? They invent businesses. Ah, I know what we'll do. We'll start funding businesses based on their, or there's some sort of acronym for it, like total addressable market size or something like that. And so we'll just create these stories and we'll get these CEOs that are very charismatic and we'll get these CFOs that don't really mind cooking the books and coming up with all these alternate ways of looking at accounting other than GAAP, generally accepted accounting principles. So they just kind of look the other way. And next thing you know, you get all this community adjusted EBITDA like they had in WeWork, which is basically just taking all their expenses off the P&L out and just adding it back as goodwill or something like that to where it somehow made them look profitable. And then you have the same thing going on in Japan, where they are dumping all their money. They can't get a return there either. So they're dumping all their money into SoftBank. Then they just fund WeWork or they fund DoorDash or Uber or Lyft or just fill in the blank for any of these companies that don't make a profit at all. So anyway, that's you get my point, right? So you got to start by understanding the only thing the Fed can do is create bank reserves. That's it. As of right now. And I think that's going to change really quick. We saw it change back in March, but that's a whole other tangent that I could go off on. So it starts by understanding that. Then the banks, they look around, they have extra balance sheet capacity. They don't want to lend it to entrepreneurs. They think it's better risk reward to lend it to hedge funds and financial institutions that are going to drive up the stock market. That's going to bring in retail as well. The Fed's going to do their job by making everyone believe there's a Fed put. And then it's just this, it's this feedback loop that just takes the stock market higher and higher and higher. While in the meantime, it really kind of has this effect of gutting the real economy because that capital isn't going into the creation of manufacturing and actually creating stuff. That it's just going into financializing the economy. But at the end of the day, the economy is only as wealthy as the goods and services it creates. A measurement of the wealth of an economy isn't how many green pieces of paper there are. That doesn't make us wealthy. What makes us wealthy is the goods and services. And if we're creating fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer profitable businesses that create goods and services, we are getting poorer as a society. And people might look around and say, George, look at all these amazing businesses that have come up since 2008. Yeah, name one that makes profit. Sure, there's a couple, but I read a statistic the other day And I think I used it in one of my videos. It was like 70 or 80% of the IPOs. So the businesses that have gone public in like 2019 and 2020 are not making a profit. So, I mean, listen, in my book, you're not a business until you can actually make a profit, because a business isn't a business, in my opinion, unless it's sustainable. A business that is just churning money, that's a Ponzi scheme. That's not a business. So yeah, we've created a lot of Ponzi schemes for sure, but I don't think that's made us any richer. I think in the long run, it's made us poorer. And at some point, it's going to be time to pay the fiddler. Is that point in 2 months or 10 years? I don't know. Like, all we can do is analyze the fundamentals of the economy and be red-pilled, for lack of a better word, about the economic environment that we live in. And therefore, hopefully, we can make better decisions for ourselves and our families over the long run based on the probabilities. But you can't come to... you can't even guess as to what the probabilities may be of XYZ outcome unless you're educated, unless you watch live streams like this and podcasts like Micro Voices and watch Real Vision and watch Making Sense by Jeff Snyder. You guys got to do that, and then you can have a better chance of making good educated decisions. So that's a good question to start there. Well, I was going to say that's going to be my rant or my tangent for the day, but you guys know me better than that. I'll definitely go off on another tangent for sure. How does debt monetization happen in Europe? What's the European equivalent to the TGA account? I'm not sure what the European equivalent to the TGA is, Tom, but basically debt monetization is pretty much the same, whether it's in Europe or the United States, or usually that's kind of off in the realm of a banana republic, but as of late, the United States and Europe has been doing the banana republic stuff as well. That just means that there's really no difference between the treasury or the government and the central bank, in the sense that the government just creates debt and the central bank just buys the debt immediately. That's basically debt monetization. So the central bank is just creating new currency units or fugazis or bank reserves, whatever you want to call them. And that's what they're using to buy the debt from the government. And then the government is taking those bank reserves, in the case of the United States, and they are using those to back up these newly written checks that they send out into the economy that creates additional M2 money supply, or in other words, it creates additional commercial deposits in the commercial banking system, which are liabilities for the commercial bank system. It creates more currency units out there chasing the same amount of goods and services. Now, I know Snyder and a lot of people that are a lot smarter than I am would say, yes, it may be increasing the amount of bank deposits, but what's happening in the shadows is decreasing the deposits a lot faster. And that may be true, but just considering what we can see, that's how debt monetization works. So let me just reiterate: the government issues the bonds, the central bank buys them, and then the treasury or the government takes the money in whatever form they get it from the central bank, and then they spend that out into the economy. So the money isn't recirculating; there's new money that's being created, and in the form of the United States. Now, I would assume that it's similar or the exact same in Europe, but I don't know, because I don't know if their version of the TGA is held at the ECB or it's an actual deposit account within the commercial banking system. And that would matter. That would matter a lot, because then I'd have to see the flows and I'd have to do a whiteboard video on it. But then they would most likely be extracting that money before they spent it back in. In the case of the United States, they're not extracting the money in the first place because it's coming from the Fed, right? So anyway, I don't want to go down that rabbit hole, But that's basically debt monetization. Okay, George, what is the role of tithing in personal wealth creation? I think that's a personal decision. And I think if you were brought up with the belief system that that's what you do, then that's what you do. I don't think there's a one size fits all there. What I would say is when it comes to charity, let's call it, it's very tricky. And I know this because I've gone down this kind of mental journey myself. And as an example, when I was in Ecuador, I was trying to think about what I could do. This was after I retired, a couple of years after I retired. But I was on the coast of Ecuador and hanging out in a lot of these kind of fishing villages in this surf town, more specifically called Montanita, on the coast of kind of right in the middle of Ecuador. And I was doing a lot of surfing, but in the side, I wanted to do something, you know, to help out the community. So I thought, well, maybe I'll do like a micro lending thing where I'll have people meet like once a week, and then I'll go over there, I'll get their ideas, and then maybe I'll fund a couple of these ideas with these micro loans of like, you know, maybe $1,000 or $5,000 or something like that. And I thought about all the time it would take me to do that and what the best case scenario would be, right? That you fund maybe, I don't know, three or four businesses locally where they're making sweaters or something like that, and that would sustain the family or maybe a few other people in the community. And long term, that would improve their lives. And I thought, okay, well, so I kind of calculated how many people I would be helping total if things went really well. So let's just say that number was 50. Then I went and said, okay, well, if it doesn't work out, then how many people will I be helping? And then let's say the number was like 10. And then I thought about it, and I'm like, but wait a minute here. When I run my businesses, I help way more people than that. Like, just for a second, let's think about, and it's what I'm doing in retirement. Like, this isn't even counting what I did prior to retiring. But right now, let's juxtapose that to what I'm doing in Colombia, where I've got Angie and Joaquin. As you guys know, those are my husband and wife team that runs my real estate operations in Colombia for me. And under them, you know, when you take and you consider all the subcontractors that work for me through Angie and Joaquin, and then you look at all the people in the YouTube channel that work for me, my editors, my Sebastian, most of you guys know or have heard Sebastian's name, Danny, Thomas, Catherine, the gal that does all my thumbnails, my assistant, Adriana, my accounting gal, Anna, they all live in Medellin, Colombia. So you take all these people and then you look at, so I'm supporting their entire family, right? And then you look at how their wives, then you look at their kids, and a lot of them are supporting their parents. You look at how many people that I am supporting with a business that's completely sustainable, right? That gives them long-term security. And it's way more than the people than the best case scenario with that micro lending. And then I got to thinking about it. I'm like, it's even more sustainable because with the micro lending, you know, a lot of these people, and I was going to do like these classes once a week to help them with their business, but I couldn't do it forever. You know, I might be able to do it for 6 months or a year to get them kind of up on their feet. But at the end of the day, I would have to unplug myself from the equation, where in Colombia, I'm always part of the equation. And what comes along with George Gammon is not just additional capital, but even more importantly, the know-how and the experience of someone who's been in the trenches as an entrepreneur since basically the late 90s. Let's call it since 2000. So for 20 years, you've got a guy that's built up businesses, that's had a lot of them fail, but had a lot of them succeed as well. and has done everything from ad agencies to convention businesses to TV shows, as you guys know, to real estate and YouTube channels and online and everything in between. That's when you got that guy or gal running the show, it's going to be far more sustainable. So my point is, I came to the conclusion that if I really wanted to help people, if I really wanted to be altruistic and help the most people possible on this planet, I wouldn't do charity. I would come out of retirement and create businesses that that I ran that made me money, but that just helped a lot more people and had the ability to help them a lot longer. So that's one of the main reasons why kind of the catalyst to me starting all of the real estate ventures that I started outside of the United States. And then that's what led me to the TV show. That's what led me to the YouTube channel and everything else. So I love the question, because I was brought up as in the Christian church, and you know, my family paid tithe, and it was something that I did early on. But then I just started to think. See, but the thing is here, let me, and I don't want to go off on a tangent here like I already have, but not everyone can do that. See, some people would have been better for them to start the micro lending. You have to be honest with yourself about what your strengths and your weaknesses are. You've got to be honest with yourself. Because again, if I didn't have my skill set or the skill set that I have, I might not have helped the most people. I might have helped less people by coming out of retirement, right? It all depends. And I, you know, the example I use there is Bill Gates. And I know everyone likes to beat up on Bill Gates, and I'm not, let's just exclude the Bill Gates of the whole Cerveza sickness and just go back to the Microsoft Bill Gates for a moment. You know, when he first started Microsoft, he got like $400,000 to start the company. If he would have taken that money and just given it away back in, let's say, the early or the mid 80s or whatever, everyone would have thought, oh my gosh, he's doing the right thing. He's being charitable. He's being altruistic. He is helping mankind. But instead, so think about how many people he would have helped by giving away that $400,000. Or he could have taken it, built up Microsoft, and think about how many people today are better off as a result of what he did with Microsoft and, you know, helping entrepreneurs, helping the employees. I mean, it's limitless how many people have benefited from Microsoft existing, right? And as a result of Bill Gates taking that 400 and instead of giving it away, investing it in his own business, right? And I know, everyone's going to come down hard on Bill Gates. I'm not talking about the current Bill Gates. I'm talking about the Bill Gates circa 1985, all right? But you could, I mean, plug in anybody. Plug in your favorite entrepreneur, right? Plug in me if you want to. I got a business loan back in, what was it? I mean, it wasn't from a bank or anything. It was from a guy that I sold a business for. This would have been 2006, maybe, right around there. It was for $400,000. And same thing. You know, if I would have given that away, everyone would have thought I was a saint, and then I would have had to pay the guy back somehow and figure that out. But instead, I took that money and pursued my own self-interest and built up multiple businesses. The last one that I retired from had over 100 employees. So, but you see, the key there is, if I didn't have the skill set to be successful as an entrepreneur, you probably would have helped more people, or possibly, by giving it away. You see, it starts by knowing your strengths and weaknesses. That's what you got to do. And let me say one more thing here. If your objective is just to help the most people possible, if your objective is just to feel good, which, let's be honest, most people that give to charity, that's their main goal. It's to feel good. It's not to help the most amount of people. So if your objective is to help the most amount of people, that's what you want to do, what I just said there for the last 5 minutes. But if your only objective is just to feel good, well, then give away the money.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
How much are other countries paying with COVID or paying citizens? In Colombia, when I left Troy, and I have not been there for, oh boy, when did I leave? When did I leave? Like June or something? I can't remember when I left. I went to St. Bart's. But anyway, I left in maybe the early summer 2020. So as of that time, they had not given out any stimulus checks. The only thing they had done is they provided rice and I think rice and beans. They set up like shelters or kind of food shelters where the poor people in the area, if they needed food, they could come down there and get free rice and free beans. And that's it. So that was their stimulus package. Obviously, that works a little bit better when you have a housing market where no one has a mortgage. Right? Think that one through. I read a statistic that out of all the people that own property in Colombia, only like, there's like either like 3 or 7% have a mortgage. So if you have an entire society that doesn't have a mortgage payment and they can just, you know, crash with their family for a while, I mean, they got running water, they got drinking water. The water is very drinkable in Medellin. So I'm pretty sure that's all you need. You got rice and beans, you can sustain yourself for a few months. Not going to be pleasant, but they're not going to have to put you 6 feet under. You're not going to die as a result. So now they could have changed that since I have been there. I don't know, but that's what they were doing. That was the stimulus package when I was there, rice and beans. And you got to remember, Troy, that not very few countries can do that because they can't see, like the United States this year is running almost a $5 trillion deficit, or their debt is going up by almost $5 trillion. I know there's different ways to measure it. I always just say the deficit is however much their debt has gone up, which you would think everyone would do that. But for whatever reasons, there's different ways. But it's, you know, people have been saying it's between like 3.5 and 5 trillion that the deficit has gone up. Colombia can't do that. There's no way. They could, but their currency would just turn into pixie dust. I mean, their currency would just be inflated to oblivion. That's what most countries, they are bound by economic reality. We're in the United States and in Europe and to a certain degree Japan, because though there's so much demand for those currencies outside of the domestic economy, and that can be temporary, let's remember, that we can get away with all this nonsense. We can get away with economic insanity. We can get away with defying physics from an economic standpoint for quite a while before we have to pay the price. So, you know, again, I can answer this just by knowing that most countries couldn't do that or couldn't do what we've done in the United States. Just economically, they wouldn't be able to survive it. So to answer your question directly, how much are other countries paying citizens for COVID relief? Less. A lot less. somewhere between less and zero. What am I personally doing to prepare for the economic collapse or the Great Reset? Well, those are kind of two different questions. I mean, what I'm doing is just trying to focus on countries that are most likely going to give Klaus the middle finger. And you can look at these, and a lot of people come in and say, oh, well, you have no control, the Great Reset, they're, you know, the global elite are just going to, you don't understand how powerful they are, George. They're just going to do whatever they want to across the whole globe, and we don't have any say in the matter. Most of the people that I hear that from are Americans or Canadians that really haven't spent too much time outside of the country. If you're someone that's been to 40, 50 countries, you get that there are many countries out there that have no problem whatsoever giving the middle finger to whatever is going on in the West. That's for sure. So maybe in the past that's been a bad thing. Maybe in the future that'll be a good thing. We have to keep an open mind. So there's a lot of country where if you look at the Great Reset agenda, that would completely destroy a lot of countries out there, such as the Middle East. Not that that's a country, but that whole region. Russia, Brazil. There's a lot of places that they could have a sit down with Klaus, and Klaus would say, I think it'll be great if you do this, this, and this. And they'd look at him like, you've got to be out of your mind. That would kill half of our population. Half our population would starve to death if we did that. So no, thank you. We're not playing by your rules or whatever. So I think that's where I'm starting personally, is trying to find those countries and then go to those countries and just pay attention to them, you know, like set up a Google alert or something that just goes to your email, just to kind of get a vibe for what they're doing. You know, I always listen to my buddy Andrew Henderson with Nomad Capitalist. He's got a really great podcast, by the way. If you guys aren't subscribed to that, you know, it's just free on iTunes. And he does pretty much a podcast a day, and they're great, real quick. You can just listen to them in the shower or something. They're usually like 5-10 minutes. But in a podcast he did last week, I believe, it was either last week or the week prior, he was talking about how the UAE is considering a program where they might issue passports and grant citizenship to people who were not born there. And they've never done this in the past. They had like a golden visa type thing for people who wanted to retire in Dubai, from what I understand. But they had never floated the idea of actually granting people citizenship. Now, keep in mind, it's not going to be one of these things like St. Lucia, where you can go in there, drop $100,000, and they give you a passport. That's not what it's most likely going to be. You're going to have to jump over a lot of hoops. You have to learn Arabic or whatever, you know. You've got to probably be there for 5+ years. It's not going to be easy, but that's not the point. The point is they're going in the right direction. So if you sit there and said, George, as of right now, where would you rather live, in the United States or in Saudi Arabia? I mean, okay, you got me, right? The United States. I'd probably rather live in the United States right now. But it's not to say that I would rather live in the United States in 15 years. Right? We can't just take a snapshot of the globe right now as far as personal liberty and just assume that it's going to be that way indefinitely for the rest of our lives. It's the only thing that we can count on in this life is change. So let's right now, not that we have to move there, but for our investments and to get a good idea of what's happening around the world, what I'm doing is looking at those countries that will most likely not go along with the World Economic Forum and the IMF. And by the way, I don't know if someone texted me on Twitter the other day about that John Kerry article where he was talking about the Biden administration, and they were talking about the Great Reset specifically. And John Kerry was saying that they've not only adopted the Great Reset agenda, but they are going to be rolling it out in the United States far faster than most people understand. That was kind of the sub heading of the article. If I should look for it tonight. If I find it tonight, that whomever sent that to me, I'll like retweet it so you guys can see what I'm talking about. But you know, that's what you're dealing with here in the United States. So, you know, McIntosh, Chris McIntosh, my partner, one of my partners in Rebel Capitalist Pro, he's of the mindset that you're gonna have a lot of capital moving towards those areas who are embracing free market capitalism and not trying to move away from it to like a socialist utopia type thing. And so again, that would be Eastern Europe, that would be Russia, that would be the Middle East, Brazil, a couple other places. Another thing that I thought was very interesting, if you guys listened to one of the most recent Macro Voices episode with Kyle Bass, and my good buddy Eric Townsend interviewed Kyle, and they were talking about this mass exodus of human capital and capital from Hong Kong because of what's going on with China, and that all those people most likely are going to go down to Singapore. And I think Singapore could be really, I mean, it's been I loved it. I've spent a lot of time there back 2010, 2011. And, but maybe even for the next 10, 20 years, Singapore could be, it's already kind of the place in that area, but it might gain even more traction. And from a financial hub, I think that's another country that would just look at the World Economic Forum, and they might say nice things about them, but at the end of the day, they'd tell them to pound sand. That's what I would expect after having spent as much time as I have in 2010, 2011. Granted, that was 9, 10 years ago, so maybe things have changed. But I started to think about that over the weekend, that if someone asked me about like currencies that I like, I don't know. I mean, I don't like any fiat currency, but if I had to go with one and hold it for like 10 years, I don't know, it might be the Singapore dollar. Not saying, let's see, that's not investment advice. I'm not doing that. But I'm thinking about that a little bit more. What do gold, silver, Bitcoin sell off and drop in price when stock market returns? Aren't they supposed to be a store value? Yeah, but you're just looking at liquidity, Harvey. So when the stock market drops, you know, they get, these managers get margin calls and they have to sell whatever they can sell. So that's going to be gold, silver, Bitcoin, stuff like that. And that's usually why when you see the market go down dramatically, you do see a sell-off in assets that are liquid. But then kind of once that sell-off turns and goes the other direction, you usually see the same with those assets that were used as liquidity. Okay, why do banks exchange treasuries with bank reserves if they don't lend the reserve? Well, keep in mind, Ian, they never lend reserves. Banks can't lend reserves. That's not what they're lending. They're using the reserves to back up new additional loans. And I know it's kind of getting technical there, but it's really important that we all understand the difference. Because if you think that banks lend reserves, then you see them as more of an intermediary, where they're not. Banks, commercial banks, are creating additional money supply. You see? So they take one bank reserve and they use that to back up, let's say, $10 in newly created loans. Right? The bank reserves never leave they never are used to create an additional deposit in the commercial banking system, unless they're used to create or to back up, it's probably a better way of saying it, a new loan that does create additional currency units or additional bank deposits in the real economy. See, so I know I'm kind of getting technical there, but I think it's important that we understand that, so we see banks as creators of new money supply, not just distributing current existing money supply. What do you see as a contrarian play in the current environment? Well, I mean, I've been kind of in vacation mode, so I haven't really looked at what's going on with commodities. I haven't really looked at what's going on. I know Bitcoin, I think, has really gone through the roof. I think contrarian play in the current, maybe in the Singapore dollar. Maybe I don't want to see. You can tell I've been thinking about that because I keep going back to that. But I don't want to. I haven't really thought that through, so I don't want to. Please don't take that as advice. And also, please understand that I'm just thinking about it. I'm not doing that myself. I'm not buying the Singapore dollar right now. Although I think I do own some. I'd have to look in. Yeah, I think I do own a little bit. But I'm not buying them. But contrarian play. So, I mean, I still like coal. I like tobacco. Like, that's contrarian. I'm kind of warming up to real estate in Dubai, although I can't give you a straight answer there until I go there physically and actually look at the market, because, you know, I just have to kick tires. Contrarian play, maybe the gold miners. I mean, wasn't it like a couple weeks ago when I looked at them, they were down a little bit. Maybe they've had a pop, but I know, you know, everyone's getting super, super hyper focused on crypto and Bitcoin. They're kind of forgetting about the gold miners, and maybe that's kind of a contrarian play. But then normally, like you guys know, I'd say commodities. The commodities have had a huge, huge run. Now, that said, there still are a lot of them that are cheap historically, but boy, they've had a lot. We started talking about commodities on my channel. I started talking about it in like January, February. But in Rebel Capitalist Pro, we started talking about commodities since day one, since I set up Rebel Capitalist Pro like 6 months ago, because Chris and Lynn, you know, we're all kind of on the same page there. And boy, that turned out to be a real good call. Even the coal ETF that I own, they like dismantled it the other day or whatever. But my goodness, in the interim, it went up, it like doubled. It went up by like 100%. And Lynn, you know, Lynn was texting me the other day on Twitter when we were talking about the coal ETF just dissolving itself or whatever. And she said, hey, that could be one hell of a contrarian indicator. Like, yep, there you go. So I'll just leave you with those ideas. If you want more, I would check out Rebel Capitalist Pro and go through all the live streams. And you can get like a week trial for $1, so you can't beat it. Hi, George. Raul said he sold all of his gold for Bitcoin. Genius, foolish, or pump and dump? Okay, so I that's a good question. And you guys have to understand that when you look at your portfolio, you have to consider your entire life. Like, you have to look at not just your balance sheet, but you have to look at your P&L. And I can't remember if we were recording when I was talking to Raul about this. It might have been like prior or after us recording, because I can't remember whether it got on the podcast. But he was talking about his rationale for doing what he did. And a big component of that was he has so much cash flow coming in from his businesses that he can afford to take maybe a little bit more risk and go into an asset that's quite a bit more volatile than someone else that didn't have any cash flow coming in at all. So I know a lot of people on FinTwit, they look at what Raul did and they just... Well, if Raul did it, it's good enough for me. He's a lot smarter than I am, and I'm going to go ahead and do that as well. But what they don't see in a holistic approach. They don't see it in its the total of what he's doing when you look at the P&L and the balance sheet. They just see that one component of what he does. You know, if you, let's say you've got a $50 million portfolio and you bought, I don't know, let's say 30 million in Bitcoin. Well, that's a lot different if you're retired and you have $50 million compared to you've got a $50 million portfolio and you're making $3 million a year and you're 45 years old. Like, that's a big, big difference, right? So make sure that you're using that as a starting point. And so, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is for some people, yeah, that would be foolish. For other people, it could be genius. Now, I would say for 99%, and this is why I always talk about the 10-80-10 type portfolio, and this is why I say that I don't really think it's too good of an idea to take all your eggs and put them in one basket, you know, take 90% into Bitcoin as an example. I'm kind of using that as a blanket statement for 99.9% of the population. But I don't think that's right for everybody. Another thing you got to realize is Raul is a pro. It's what he does for a living. He's been through this. He's lived this for decades. So Raul is going to know when to sell. He's going to know when to buy. More importantly, Raul can control his emotions. Where most amateurs, like me included, like if I had 90% of my portfolio in one asset, what are you doing? You're looking at your phone every single day. You're probably looking at it every minute, looking at the price. Oh, what's Bitcoin doing now? What's gold doing now? What's this stock doing now? What are my Tesla shares doing? What are my Apple shares doing? Right? If you've got your portfolio set up in a way where you're checking your phone every 5 minutes, getting price quotes, it ain't set up the right way. I can tell you that right now. And I can guarantee you, Raul is not looking at the price of Bitcoin every minute. There's no way, you see? So you not only have to look at your P&L and your balance sheet, but you also have to look at your skill set. You have to look at how much experience you have, and you have to look at how emotional you are or you're going to be about your portfolio. And just the fact that we're all human beings, that means that we're hardwired for emotion. The person that can look at their portfolio just like a robot, they are the anomaly. They aren't the norm. And so we need to admit that about ourselves, understand that that's a weakness for investors. And we have to set up our portfolio accordingly, right? So I think that's probably the best way because, you know, Raul is a brilliant guy. And for him, maybe this was genius. I think for 99.999% of people out there, I think it, I don't want to say anything that Raul does would be foolish, but I don't think it would be a good idea. Let's put it that way. And let me be clear. It's not to say that I'm not bullish on Bitcoin. Short term, I am very hesitant because of how much emotion is in Bitcoin right now. Long term, I'm more bullish, but it's the same with gold. You know, I think everyone should own 10% of their portfolio should be in gold. But it's not to say that I think you should buy 100 or you should have 100% of your portfolio in gold. That's a much, much different question.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
At what point does the Fed's balance sheet pass say, a confidence boundary where confidence in the central bank and the dollar collapse? Is it a calculated number? No, Zach. It's a great question, buddy. But no, there's no line in the sand where if you said, okay, once the Fed's balance sheet gets to $10 trillion, that's it. Everyone's going to sell their dollars. There's no way of knowing that. And it's psychological. But it has to do with a lot of things. I mean, there's so many cross currents. Psychology is definitely one of them and one of the more powerful for sure. But look at the Bank of Japan. I mean, Bank of Japan owns 60% of their government debt. They're, what, 230, 40% debt to GDP? I mean, it sounds shocking to say it out loud, but even as bad as the U.S. is, the profligate spending hasn't reached those levels yet. It's not to say that just because it didn't blow up in Japan up until this point means that it won't blow up in the United States. Another thing too, guys, let's all remember that in my opinion, the problems in Japan aren't necessarily all in the future. And I think that's the way, as Austrians, and I don't know if I put myself in that camp totally, but I obviously a lot of my views lean toward that school of thought. So as Austrians, we like to think that, well, once you get to 200, 250% debt to GDP, there's so much debt that at some day they're going to have a reckoning. Like it's time for Japan to pay the fiddler. And all of those excess misallocations of resources or malinvestments, that's going to come home to roost. But I don't know. Because I would argue, and I've argued this on several of my whiteboard videos, that the damage might not be in the future for Japan. The damage might have been done in the past and in the present, meaning that just by the government spending all the money that took them, let's say from 100% debt to GDP to 230% debt to GDP, that distorted the economy to such a great degree that the suffering has already been occurring in Japan by the economic malaise that the government spending created in the first place, right? We all know that they've been in deflation and they've had all of these economic problems. So I think that the best analogy I can use is one I've used many times and I used in one of my whiteboard videos. And that's of a heroin addict that runs up $100,000 on a credit card to buy heroin. And then us coming in and saying, oh my gosh, look at that. They've got $100,000 in credit card debt. Whoo boy, one of these days, it's going to come back to bite them. Yeah, but they're a heroin addict. So I think it's already come back to bite them, right? The problem isn't in the future. The problem is how damaged their body and their mind is now by taking the drugs, the heroin, in the first place. And even if you came in and what gave them a debt jubilee, let's say, would they be any better? No, they would be worse because now they've got a credit card with a zero balance again, and they're just going to go out and buy another $100,000 worth of heroin, which is most likely going to kill them this time. You see, so that's the best analogy that I can use for a government in that, and how this goes back to your question, Zach, is right now the Fed's balance sheet is going through the roof. Why? Because they're having to monetize the debt. They're monetizing the debt from the government deficit spending. The government deficit spending is the heroin addict buying the heroin and injecting it right into their arm. That's government deficit spending. Because of the misallocation of resources, how badly it distorts the economy, and because of the malinvestment, okay? So just replace the word government deficit with heroin injection, and then I think you'll see it clearly. So how much heroin can the U.S. economy withstand? I don't know. But unfortunately, I think we're going to find out. If I have more than two properties, I get taxed. Okay, so an increased tax. Okay, is that the same thing the rest of the world? No, it's not. I mean, it's going to be different from country to country. I've never heard of anything that like that, where your taxes actually increase if you have more than two homes. I'd assume they're doing that to try to penalize real estate investors, or try to give a break to just homeowners, like owner occupants. But the places where I've done business in real estate, that being South America and the United States, that is not the case. Although in the United States, you do get, I don't think you have to pay cap gains on your primary residence up to, what is it, maybe 400, 500, something like that, depending on whether or not you're a married couple. So there is something a little bit like that, but it's still, regardless of how many homes you sell, it would still qualify for long-term cap gains. And then in Colombia, I don't think there's any limit on it whatsoever. And the cap gains in Colombia are a little bit different in the sense that long-term cap gains kicks in after 2 years, not 1 year, but the rate's only 10%. So yeah, it's going to be different in every place. It's just, some places are way different. Some places aren't that different. But yeah, that's pretty draconian. If I was 29, what would I do? First thing's house hack. And so that means buy a triplex or duplex, fourplex. And hopefully you'd be in an area. Well, let me actually back up here. I would only do that if I was in an area where I could get positive cash flow. I wouldn't leverage myself and take too much risk. So I, assuming that you could have positive cash flow and your tenants would pay the mortgage for you. So on top of that, you're still putting money in your pocket after all your mortgage is paid, all your insurance is paid, all your utilities, all the property taxes, all your expenses are covered. You're still, let's say, putting $200 or $300 a month in your pocket. If you live in an area where that's possible in a good neighborhood, then that's what I do. I think that's the best thing that young people can do to secure their financial future. And then what you do is take the money you would have spent on the mortgage or the rent payment, invest. So most people's main expense, most Americans, is their housing cost, whether that's rent or a mortgage, maybe outside of taxes. Taxes is probably even more for higher earners. But for most people outside of taxes, it's going to be your housing payment. So if you can eliminate that housing payment and take that money and put it into investing in, like a 1080-10 type portfolio or real estate, or, things that pay you to own them, and gold and some speculative assets, over the long run, you're going to be all set. I mean, if you're 29 right now, if you execute on this, by the time you're 50, you're going to be jamming. So that's what I would do. And then while I was working my 9-to-5 gig, assuming that's what you're doing, I'd have my house hack, so my triplex. Then I'd work my 9-to-5 gig to pay the bills, have a couple extra $100 coming in, positive cash flow to pay some other bills. And I would, zero consumer debt, none. Don't even think about using a credit card. You're using smart debt in the form of that mortgage, and make sure you got a fixed rate on that. And then I would try to come up with some sort of hustle, some sort of side hustle for the nights and weekends online that I really enjoyed, or maybe I could leverage the skills that I'm learning in my 9-to-5 and just keep building it until it gets to a point where your cash flow coming in from your side hustle, and you might fail at a few, I'm sure, but that's fine. That doesn't matter. That's what we do as entrepreneurs. We just throw things up against the wall and we just keep iterating. We see what sticks. We move forward and just keep going and going and going. And so then once your side hustle is making, let's say, $5,000 a month and your gig is only making $4,000 a month, then you're taking all that additional money, you're putting that into your investment portfolio. And then I'd get to a point where I would move. I would go to a place where that had, in my opinion, a higher standard of living, and the cost of living was significantly lower. And then I would take the delta between my expenses and living very, very well, mind you, in another area. And then I'd take that and continue to just put into the investment pool, whether you're buying real estate, dividend paying stocks, bonds, you know, international stocks, who knows what it is, Bitcoin, gold, miners, etc. That's what I'd do if I was 29. Actually, I'd probably flip stuff too, just thinking about it. I'd probably flip stuff as well. So I'd do the side hustle. I'd do the house hack. I'd work my 9 to 5, but on weekends, I'd probably flip stuff, because that's something you can do. It doesn't take much time. And that is going to give you a really, really good education when it comes to investing in real estate, if that's something you want to pursue more long term. So just to clarify, we got house hack, we've got side hustle, we've got flipping and reinvesting all of the excess money you have, no consumer debt. Once you get to a point with a side hustle, think about moving to another country, or at least maybe another state, where the cost of living is much lower, but the quality of life is the same or better. And then just keep reinvesting. George, why and what percentage of your Colombian properties are you selling? You say buy cheap, sell high. You think Colombia will plateau. No, I'm not selling. I take that back. I did a project with my sister down there, and we were selling it. I'd have to talk to Angie. I think actually we're renting that out right now, just because the whole Cerveza deal, it's obviously not a good time to be a seller. It's a good time to be a buyer, but not a seller. So we're just renting out everything in Colombia. We've had to drop our rents a little bit, but fortunately, we've maintained very high occupancy rates, but we've had to drop rents by about maybe 15, 20%, something like that. But like I said, we're still able to get people in there, so that's good. And the model, Mike, is a little bit different, because it's not really real estate investing. I don't know if I'd consider what I do in Colombia real estate investing, because it's not passive at all. For me, it is, but that's because I was there working at it 4 years straight, building up a team of people that now do it for me. So I just try to, you know, I make all my money on the buy side. I buy a dollar for 50 cents in Colombia, and then I fix it up and I just sell it, boom. And that's kind of the business model. So it's not really investing. It's more like a kind of a little side hustle business, like a house flipping business. Now, there are some properties that I do keep in a portfolio, and I would consider those long-term investments. And my mentality up front is the same. I want great cash flow, but I'm trying to build a ton of equity by buying super, super cheap and then remodeling to force the appreciation. But I think the best way I can say it is that my mindset for when to sell is much different, because it's more like a side hustle business. It's not really an investment. I just want to turn that capital over as quickly as I can in most cases, because I've got a team of people that I know are going to be able to produce, let's say, an 80% return on that capital per year, compared to maybe, let's say, a 15% return if I just bought everything and then just kept it in a rental portfolio and never sold it. And bear in mind, that 15% does not include the equity appreciation that I would have got by buying low and doing the remodel. I don't really factor that into the equation until I sell. But you could, there'd be an argument for increasing your balance sheet significantly on the asset side as a result of that forced appreciation. But that would just be a paper gain until you sell. And if it's a rental property, you don't really want to sell. So anyway, I don't want to get too technical on it. But that's the bottom line, is the property I do in real estate, I usually have a different rationale for selling, because it's not really in the investment category. It's more of a side hustle business. Okay, guys, thanks for hanging out with me on this Sunday. I want to remind everyone to go and check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. It is the best way to build wealth and thrive in a world of out of control central banks and big governments. But seriously, guys, you have a lot of fun. You can learn a lot. The live streams are amazing. The community is amazing. And obviously, the research from Lynn and Chris is just absolutely next level. So check that out at georgegammon.com/pro. And let me do some shout outs for everyone. We had a lot of people on the live stream. I think we had well over 1,200 people today. So that's super cool. Let me do some shout outs for everyone that was hanging out all the way till the end. We've got Feds, Champ, Jim Wolf, David V, Whitney Two Cents, Kim, good to see you. All Nighter, Heater, Joker Alpha, Mexi Mike, John Smiley, Deal Donkey on Twitter. Alrighty then. Erica, AA, Dave, Kreese, Nicholas, got some good questions in there. Thank you, my friend. John, Michael Douglas, Micro Business Media, Zorina Pace, Shane Brewer, Cryptic Gamer, Martin Burke Lad, Sufina. And I can't. Oh, there it is. Sufina Ali, Alberto, Zarina, Cousin Joe, Matthew Peterson, J.R. Moxley, R.R., Drew, Martis. All right, guys. Appreciate you hanging out with me, and I will see you on the next video.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com. Or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.